From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. At the University of Missouri on Monday, a skirmish over media access in a much larger battle over racial discrimination. Just 100 miles from Ferguson, student protests led University President Tim Wolf to resign.
Wolf was under fire for not addressing racially charged incidents on campus. Black students complained of repeated racial slurs. A swastika was found in a dorm. Some say there's been racial tension on the predominantly white campus for years.
For a week, an African-American graduate student named Jonathan Butler staged a hunger strike that he said would only end with Wolf's resignation.
Also Monday, an altercation.
You need to go.
Yep.
Students, can you tell him how
you
much
you don't have a right
have
to take our photos?
A student photographer, Tim Tai, on assignment for ESPN, explained his rights as the protesters refereed access to the university quad, calling it a media-free safe space and linking arms to keep reporters out.
This is the First Amendment that protects your right to stand here, protects mine.
The same video showed a communications professor calling for muscle to keep reporters out. She's since apologized, but too late. Condemnation of the assault on press freedom was swift and fierce. Stephen Thrasher, a writer at large for The Guardian U.S., reported from the campus. As a journalist and an African American, first he was stunned, and then he got it.
The thing that was really shocking for me that I started hearing were these chants that I've heard. I've covered Occupy Wall Street, I've covered Black Lives Matter over the past few years, and I heard them using these chants that have typically been deployed against the police. Back up, back up, we want freedom, freedom, and they were directing it towards the media. I thought, what is it that they are protesting against? On the one hand, I realized they were protesting media that has misrepresented what they've been doing in the Black Lives Matter movement, particularly in Ferguson, which is not far away. And when I thought about the relationship with the police, protesters often talk about how in the Black Lives Matter movement that there is a systemic racism that pervades policing. It's not about good cops and bad cops. It's not about white cops or black cops. They're saying that the whole system is racist. And I felt like they were also saying the media is systemically racist. So it doesn't matter whether I'm a good journalist or a bad journalist or a black journalist. They are very distrustful of the system itself.
Right. I can see that. But this is a public university. This protest was taking place in a public space. You wrote about a sense of privilege. You're used to being able to walk wherever you want when you're covering a demonstration. You noted that, of course, you wouldn't go to a concert in a public park and demand to be let backstage. But is that really the right parallel? I mean, we're talking about basic access. Is that privilege?
Why I think that this was so hard for media is, one, I mean, we don't like to be told we can't go into some place. That's fine. But also, I don't think a lot of media professionals are used to having the terms of any interaction with young black people dictated to them. You know, they're not used to a young black person saying, this is what's going to happen and this is how we're going to interact with each other. They had hashtags on their signs, so they had a real sense that they could get media out without the media. They could kind of go around us. They kept asking people to email them. They didn't want students sort of giving interviews off the cuff. And they just wanted a space that they could talk without media being right in their face where they were sleeping for several days. These protesters are incredibly sophisticated and intelligent. They understand systemic racism very well, and they read media through that lens. So they don't think it's necessarily about one person or the other. This is completely my speculation, but I think one of the things they very specifically did not want by that safe space is they didn't want a camera finding one person goofing off and then having that be the image of their movement. I mean, I think one reason why they turn away from this kind of media is because they see it as reductive when they think, well, I could be tweeting with people every 7 seconds. Why do I need to just have one quote that's going to stand for me and have myself judged by that one thing?
Knowing all too well how the system works. Since the confrontation, the protesters have circulated flyers about First Amendment rights, and the two professors shown in the video yelling have apologized. Why this note of reconciliation?
One, they didn't want the story to just become about that. And they got what they wanted. They went through this incredibly difficult thing and they got it. This is the first protest in the year and a half I've been covering Black Lives Matter that was organized around Black joy. And somehow we've made a way to talk about all these problems with the media. But overall, from the moment that it came out that Wolf was resigning, there was dancing, there was singing. And having covered the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, I've traveled around the country to a lot of these sites. It's always about death. It's always about sadness. And here they actually had a victory, and there was a real joy in it.
Mm-hmm. In a column on the Washington Post site, the journalist Terrell Germain Starr wrote, quote, "The Black community distrusts the news media because it has failed to cover Black pain fairly." How do you create, as a reporter, to an audience that would never have experienced it, a pathway to understanding Black pain?
It's a very difficult thing to do. You have to start by listening to people, by giving Black people the benefit of the doubt. There's something that happens so often around when a Black man is killed. The first assumption in media and popular discourse is that he did something to deserve it. You know, we saw it with the young Black woman who was hurt in the South Carolina classroom when she was slammed by the cop. There's this, oh, what was she doing? She was on her phone. Well, he must have had reason to throw her onto the ground. The young Black girl outside the McKinney pool. Oh, she spoke back to the officer to tell him, I'm walking on my way home. Well, she shouldn't have said anything and she would be okay. And you see it in Mizzou as well. Well, why are these kids so sensitive? Why can't they take being called these names? And you have to have some people who look like the people they're covering. I know this from being the only person in the room, and many times in my career, it's a hard case to make to your colleagues, and it's not easy work. It's work that takes a long time. It's work that often can't be fit very simply into a short story. And the story of Black pain is so often just commodified and exploited. Another sub-story this week has been that Jonathan Butler seems to come from a well-to-do family. That's been used to try to discredit him, because the underpinning of this country is that Black people should not be operating from a place of education or power or something other than pain.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Stephen Thrasher is a writer at large for The Guardian U.S.